Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Captain A. Frauenfelder, AFC MBE. He was the first man to win an AFC and describes the early years of the RNAS and the various aircraft of that time. This talk was recorded in September 1974 and duration is 1 hour and 20 minutes.
Now, it cannot be said that our meetings lack variety. Two meetings ago we had that fine address by Gabriel Sellers on the La Bolsa expedition. Last month we joined Captain Moyes in the Antarctic and the Mawson expedition, and tonight we are to hear the exploits of the Royal Naval Flying Service. Captain Frauenfelder was the chief instructor number 2 flying school and has a story to tell which I am quite sure will grip your attention. So now, ladies and gentlemen, I have much pleasure in introducing to you Captain Austin Frauenfelder.
As I say, I'm not accustomed to speaking any time, but I've had rather, it's the strongest thing I ever drank.
First time I've ever heard a sailor.
And that's very true. I've never had a drink in my life. And I used to smoke 20 cigarettes a day. 60 cigarettes a day. Well, gentlemen, all you young fellows, it's very hard to speak to young people. So I'll do the best I can. I'll start from the beginning. In 1914, I joined the army and we were drafted out to Randwick Racecourse. I didn't know whether they were going to make racehorses of us or what they were going to do. The first Sunday we were there, we were camped in the Ledger Grandstand, and the first Sunday they had to have church. Well, the Roman Catholics were at 6 o'clock in the morning, so we were all Catholics. Well, they lined us up in front of the grandstand. And of course, nobody knew anything about being a soldier. An officer came along and he said to me, "Have you ever done any soldering?" I said, "I've never seen one, sir." "No." He said, "Don't you know anything about it?" I said, "I can shoot with a gun." He said, "You don't call it a gun, you call it a rifle." I said, "My father was a captain of the fire brigade." And he said, "You're right, you're a sergeant." Now, this is all John's gospel. Well, it transferred us over to Kensington Racecourse. And they put me in charge of 13 platoon. There were 13 men in my section. The number of my rifle added up to 13. It seemed to follow me everywhere. When I got invalided from Gallipoli, I was wounded early and I got enteric fever. And they sent me to London to be repatriated back to Australia, or invalided out. And I met the Countess Clancarty, a real old Scotch name. And she said to me, "Would you like to join the Naval Air Service?" I said, "By Jove, I would." She said, "Well, if you give the old general over there 50 quid, he'll get you in." So I went down, reported to the Admiralty. They examined me. And the petty officer, I didn't know what a petty officer was, but it didn't make any difference. And he's standing alongside me. I said, "I can't see too well, I can't hear too well, what am I going to do?" I said, "I'll look after you." And I'd be looking at it, he'd say K, I'd say K, and he'd say G, and I'd say G, and he said, "You're all right, you're in." So, carrying on the 13th, the funniest part about it, I got in on the 13th of April, and the first aeroplane I got flown, I flew it myself. I was taught to fly on it, and it was a number 1313. And my birthday is on the 13th of March, so you can all send me a present next year if I'm still alive. I had a lot of fun in my life. Being a teetotaler is a pretty good thing. Now, the first machine that I ever got in was a box kite, a Graham White box kite. Had a nice little basket seat, handful of wire there and a handful of wire there, and a 50 horsepower engine behind my head. And the instructor sitting behind me with his hand over his shoulder, over my shoulder, and I'm holding the stick. He flew me around for 70 minutes. He landed, he said, "Well, what did you learn?" I said, "Nothing, sir." He said, "What's the matter with your hand, Zach?" "Well," I said, "I'm frightened." Well, we went on. I had a great pal in there, made a pal up with different fellas, a fellow named Glazeby. And we went on. I got a 70 minutes flight with that flight that I was frightened on, and I was frightened on every other flight afterwards, so it didn't make any difference. Anyhow, he gave me another 2 hours duel. He was a civilian, and he said to me, "Well, Hanzak," he said, I think I'll send you up a little bit windy. If the flag waves like that, it's too windy." He said, "I think you think you'd like to do a few more little ops." I said, "For Christ's sake, let me go. Let me get out of it." And he says, "Well, stick your nose down in the turns. Don't get it up. If you do, you're gone." And he said, "You think you want to do a few more little ops?" I said, "No, let me go. Get out of it." He said, "Right, on the way I go." Well, I got up to 1,000 feet, frightened to death, switched the engine off and come down to 500, got up again and down again, and up and down, and up and down, and landed it. And here's he and the CO were there, and he said, "Well, Anzac," he said, "the CO and I have been watching you. That's marvellous. Go up for 2 hours. Before he sent me for the 2 hours, he said, "Where's Glazeby?" I said, "You'll find him in the lavatory." He was that frightened. It was a funny old game. And there was a bit of a rebellion amongst the cadets. We were all cadets, see. And they didn't want to do this. We had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. That was the trouble. And of course we were always tired, and some had crashed, and the CO said to me, Frauenfelder, he said, "What's the matter with these boys?" I said, "They're all too tired, sir." I said, we're worn out. So anyhow, they decided that they'd have a go and line up, and I was to approach the CO. So I got about 25 or 30 of them all lined up outside, smart little naval officers like myself. And then I went, reported to the CO, and he come out, no, a bloody lot had cleared out. Well, this is true, I couldn't tell a lie anyhow. We had the greatest team you ever struck in your life. Well, we went on then, different flying, different types of machines, and practice. And then I was sent away to another school, with advanced, and I then, by that time, I'd flown Avros. Now, Avro was the greatest teaching machine we ever had. And you could do anything at all in it. And from that, we also had a Curtiss, an American machine. And I was drafted away from there and sent over to France. And I, Black Jack somebody, I can't think of his name now, and I see though he had a naval whiskers, you know what they're like, they christened him Black Jack. Anyhow, I had to go on a bombing raid. And it was in the double engine Codron, the French thing. And it was the fastest machine you could see. It would nearly do 50 miles an hour. And you could almost get it up to 5,000 feet. They give me a heap of bombs in the bottom of the box away. I go to Belgium, going to bomb anybody. I don't know where I had to go, because I had, we had no maps, there's no such thing as maps, you know. Anyhow, find some decent place to drop your bombs. So anyhow, I got this double engine machine, and of course, being my first trip over the lines, naturally, if you can realize how frightened I was. And the engines keep talking to me. And I thought of different things, and I remembered I owed one of my friends 10 bob, and the engine kept saying, you owe 10 bob, you owe 10 bob. Yeah, when I got over Antwerp, the maximum height I could get was 5,000. And I think there was 5,000 searchlights on me. You could read the paper in the, up in the air. So I threw all the bombs out. I didn't care where they went. I got back and the CEO said, how did you get on? What did you do? I said, I've killed all the kids in Belgium. That was my first experience over the lines. Well, I've flown over 20 types of machines. There was no machine that could master me, not one. I went from that, when I back up, going over the lines of the Codron, you'd never get into, if you'd have got into a fight, you'd never come home, and you'd shot down. But if you saw anybody, you'd clear out, so it didn't make any difference. But we had, I suppose, the greatest machines which ever were known. Was the, I got a memory like a sieve, was a Camel. The Camel was one of the greatest machines we ever had. There was nothing in the world you couldn't do on them. And they had one fault. Because I'm getting here to box myself up a bit. Anyhow, if you dive them, they were known to go underneath. I down, she'd turn under. And that happened with me one day. She's upside down, and I happened to kick the control lever with my heel, and she come back at me, and I fell back in the seat. But I was sent, when I came back from France, I was sent to the Admiralty, and I went and saw a man named Moncrief, commander. Came in, he said, "Well, Fraunfelder, we want you to go instructing." He said, "Would you like to do it?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, you can go down to Eastbourne." I said, "No, I don't want to go to Eastbourne, sir." He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, no one works there. It was one of England's best seaside resorts, and of course the airmen down there, they were playing seasides, they weren't worrying about the war or anything." He said, "Well, there's a place at Redcar up in the north of England, that's 400 or 500 miles away." And I said, "That'll do me." And he said, "You're the most extraordinary fellow I've ever struck. You can go up there. We'll give you a squadron, a night flying squadron." And I had the first night flying squadron in England. I had 6 machines and my own staff of 5, petty officer, 4 other ratings. So I walked in, I had a look at the machines, and there was a little Bristol Bullet there, the smallest machine of all. Probably none of you heard of it. It had a rotary engine in it, and it had, when you went to start them up, they used to burst into flame and you switched them off. They were monosopap engines. Well, I said to the petty officer, "Pull that machine out." "Oh," he said, "you couldn't fly that, sir." I said, "Why?" He said, "It's too much wind, they don't fly here like that." I said, "I'll fly though, that doesn't make any difference to me what they do." It was a training school that had the squadron in it. I had nothing to do with them, only I came under the CO. Well, he got out this Bristol Bullet, which was the smallest flying machine that I ever saw. And it had 110 or 120 horsepower monosopap engine, which when you switched it on, she burst into flame and you pull your pitcher off and slowly. When I got out, this petty officer there, another rating there, both with papyri and pointed at it, you see. And I said, "What are you doing with those?" He said, "It's Admiralty orders, sir." I said, "Well, you better go back to the Admiralty. Take them away. Don't use them." So I took that machine up, and I could see what was happening on the aerodrome. Everyone was watching this Australian bloke. He's going to show us something. Well, I flew out that place. I turned the thing upside down, inside out, flew down in amongst the hangars and everywhere. Not through the hangars, although I did once land one in a hangar. I flew up and down. Well, they got the shock of their lives. And it was a teaching school, and nobody had flied if it got windy. I was the only one up there who was flying. They were all windy. Anyhow, the CO sent for me. He took a fancy to me. I don't know why, whether I was a good-looking kid or not. But he said, "Now listen. We've got to send a pilot down to join up with the Royal Air Force. He said, there's a special school flying down to Southport, and I think, I forget the Southport. Anyhow, I was the first and only naval officer that ever went to that school. And they put us through. I knew nothing about flying when I got there. After a fortnight's instruction, they passed me out as an A1 pilot, of which there was only 6 1A pilots in the world. The other 5 were army men. And one of them was Major Brearley, was in Western Australia. He started a business, and then there was a Canadian and myself, Brearley, and 2 Englishmen, I think it was. Anyhow, when I came back to that school, they put me in charge of the flying. Before they put me in charge of the flying, the CO said to me, I want you to go down to Killingholme, which is near Hull, and I want you to take down 13 probationary officers, and they'll bring 13 machines back, and you bring back 1, and want you to steer them home. See? And when they got there, I'd never been Morris Farmans. They're long-horn and short-horn Morris Farmans, and I'd never flown them, and I never liked the look of them. And they're the worst looking machine you ever saw in your life. So when I got down near Killingholme, near Hull, which is a naval station, I got hold of the petty officer. I said, well, I've got to take this mob back with me. I want you to pick me out a really good machine. They're all new ones. And we're down here, Killingholme, Hull is there, and they had to fly up there and cross over Hull. It was very narrow. And I said, now you boys all fly up there, go over Hull, and I'll be last to get off the ground, I'll cut across and meet you. Well, away they go, and away I go. And when I got halfway across, the engine cut across. I've got the long stretch over the water. The engine cut out, but she picked up again. And from then on, I never saw any of them. I landed in every paddock, or between Hull and Redcar, which is about 100 miles. And I was frozen to death. Get up to about 2,000 feet, the engine cut out, down on the ground. And I got all the coffees in the country, start the engine up and everything else. I arrived home at Redcar, nobody had been there. They were all lost. When I got out, there was a major bloke there, and I said, these are the loveliest things you've ever seen in your life. They're not worth a quid. Oh, he said, you know nothing about it. I said, take it up and try it. He took it up and crashed on the first end of the first. That was the only one that came back. They were all over York, Newcastle, Darlington, God only knows where. Crashed everywhere, and anyhow, when they got them back, they pegged them all down in the ground and left them there till the wind blew them away. So they were brand new machines. Morris Farmers. Well, when I came back, I was sent down, as I told you, to the school, and I came back and was taken over as an instructor. But before, I get a bit ahead of myself at times, but when I came back, The CO said to me, Major Kilner, a Marine, he was a wonderful fellow, he said that they want you to report to the Admiralty. I said, what for? He said, I don't know. I said, well, they can't send me overseas. They have to keep me here. Oh, he said, I've got no idea. So I went down and I reported to Moncrief. I came in, they used to call me Fritz then, Fraunfelder. They used to recognise a German, so it didn't make any difference. Anyhow, he said, have a cigarette. He said, I've sent for you. There's something wrong up at that station. And I want you to tell me what it is. Well, I said, I can't be a policeman, sir. He said, you're not being a policeman. You must tell me something in the interest of the service. I said, well, if you put it that way, I must tell you they won't fly. They're frightened. He said, oh, thanks very much. Well, I said, that was the Friday. I said, I'll go back tomorrow. He said, no, have a week in London. So I had a week in London. When I got back, I was the only one there. I sent them all overseas. Now that's true. Now those men would not fly. And that's what happened. And in the Navy, they used to send round a circular, do you want to go on active service? And I abused a lot of them because they all said no. Now that's true. Fancy men having the guts to put down that. Men that have been flying for a long time. Anyhow, they all got washed out. And I took over the training and the school. And I don't know, but I know that Mr. Norris knows my... You've seen the papers of my training. I trained more men to fly in England than any man in the world. And I'm not boasting. What is it? Yeah. More than anyone in the world did. But now... I'll tell you a bit about these machines. Where's the thingamajig? Now, the box kite was my beginning. And I flew the Morris Farman, Longhorn and Shorthorn. They only come at that time when they crashed. But I got them on the top of this list here. The next machine we flew was the Avro, which was the greatest teaching machine we ever had. It had both a stationary and a rotary engine in them. But with the rotary engine, they were the best you ever struck in your life, and you could do anything in the world. Even a man full of said, McGuinness the other day, and I only found out his name, McGuinness, was at the races on Wednesday, and he said, you know, you and I are champions. He said, I know you're 5 or 6 years older than me, but he said, I've never forgotten the day you took me up at Redcar. I said, no, I never took you up at Redcar. I didn't know his name, really. He said, you put me through a course, and you said to me, now listen, I'm going to show you something. I'm going to fly this machine upside down. And you don't fall out. If you do, I'll get into trouble. So I took her on her back and spun her around on her back and smothered him and myself in oil. And now he's with Thatcher, you know, the timber people.
Yeah.
I said, you write your name down in the book. You write down in my race book. And he said, you took us over to some bloke's place. He said, when we arrived there, on a Sunday, it was 4 of us went over in the car. He said, the man came out and said to me, he said, do you drink? And I said, yes. He said, let's get drunk. He said, these are all the buggers, they don't drink. And that was George Burton, head of Burton's Brewery. And then you got plenty of free beer there. Anyhow, then I remembered him. Now, mate, it was only last Monday, the first column meeting at Randwick, and I said, put your name down in the book. And that's how I know his name's McGinnis. But I didn't remember him. But when he told me about the oil, he did it. Well, then, we other machines. I told you about the Avro, which was easily the greatest training machine we ever had. Curtis was a beauty. It was an American machine, the only American training machine we ever had, or any American machine I know of. We had the Sopwith 1.5 strutter. Was the first machine that went up to 10,000 feet in 10 minutes. But she was no good as a fighter, because she wasn't manoeuvrable enough. And she was a machine, if you got in a bit of trouble with, was likely to break up. That was the Sopwith 1.5 strutter. Then the Sopwith Scout was a wonderful little machine. Sopwith machines were all good. They all had rotary engines in them. And they've got a Sopwith triplane. I flew it once and never wanted to fly it again because I'd have never got out alive. It finished up my CO. I taught him to fly, and he went up in it, and he finished up landing at Walthamstow in the gardens. Crashed it. But it was frightfully good, but no good as a war thing. The only one was the only triplane that was ever any good, the Germans had it. Rich Stoven had one for a time. There's a Sopwith triplane, I told you that, didn't I? The Sopwith Camel was the greatest machine that ever... I showed someone here a photo of one. The Camel was the greatest machine of all. We had that right through to the end of the war, but it was a bit tricky. And if you dived, it was likely to go under. And fortunately, I found out that it did that. And she went down, and I kicked the control lever with my foot, and she come back, and I fell back in the seat. Well, then I recommended to the Admiralty that they put shoulder straps. They put them in after the war. Lovely, that was clever. Now that was the best fighting machine we had. And there's another great, there's the B-2C. Now while I was up at Redcar, when anyone was in any trouble at all, if anybody got killed, Fritz, you've got to go down to so-and-so. Someone been killed, you go down and see what's happened. So these B-2Cs, they told me they're all diving in the ground. I pulled one out and I have a look at it, and I got in it. As soon as I went off, he started to go that way. Well, I just put on the rudder and put her nose that way. If I let her go that way, she was going to dive in the ground, and that was all that he was doing. And the fellas that were flying didn't have enough brains to kick the rudder the other way, to straighten it. Murder them they were. And we could greatest 5 minutes I showed them what to do. Then there was the B-2E. It had an extension, you know, a lower wing wasn't as far as the top wing. The top plane was about that much longer. It wasn't much good anyhow. But the night flying I had to do on the 2Es. No, B's, what do you call it? The B2Cs are what I did the night flying on. I was only night flyer in England at that time. And you people can't realise it. In those days we never had a map. And what do you think we used to guide ourselves? We used to go to the railway stations and pinch their railway line maps out of their... That's how we used to find our way about. I mean, it's not believable, really. Well, they said to me, "You want to go to the seaplanes?" I said, "No, I only use water to wash with. I can't fly over the water. I wouldn't fly a seaplane. I wouldn't have that on at all. Same as the submarines. I got on top of one. I never went down. There was two commanders, Lolly, and one was Lolly anyhow. He came out here to Australia with a submarine once. But he wanted me to go down. I said, not underneath that. You've got water over the top of you. It's dangerous, you see. Holy hell. Don't laugh. There was a terrific French machine in Newport, single-seater Scout. When you landed it on the ground, you could have thrown it onto the ground, you couldn't do anything, you couldn't break it. And if you put your hand round like that to wave for someone to come round and turn you around, it would turn over itself on its back. Then you put it back on its wheels and drive it. Now that's true. You couldn't break them. And they were a great, but not as good as a camel. The camel was a beauty. A Bristol fighter, a two-seater, was the most dangerous plane in the world to tackle. Every German that tackled them got shot down. Because you carry the gunner, and they keep away from the Germans who keep away from them. They wouldn't ever go at them at all. You see, you had a gunner behind and a gunner in front. Now, no two pilots, you get two good pilots up in the air, in a single-seated plane, they can never shoot either down. All they can do is go round and round and round and round, and that's all. You can't get them. You've got no. The only way you could beat them is by sneaking on them. Well, it's pretty hard to sneak on them. Of course, you can't use goggles on them. If you use goggles on them, you can't see round here. And we used to have to fly without goggles. And if you go up in the air, your eyes fill with water straight away, practically. And then it dries up and your sight's as clear as can be. And they used to make us eat carrots to make our sight good. Everyone thought we were horses, I don't know. The Bristol fighters, I tell you, was the most dangerous thing to tackle. There's a Bristol monoplane, of which there were only three made. One finished up in South Australia. I don't know where the other one went, and I had one. I was going to, could have bought it, I could have got it for nothing. They finished up burning it. It was the best, one of the best machines I ever flew. It was a Bristol monoplane, beautiful machine, but it was never used in the war. A Spad, a French machine. My only knowledge of the Spad was that everyone that flew in them got killed, practically. But of course, get old Fritz, send him down there to York or wherever it is, test those machines, find out why these blokes are being killed. I said, well, they must be wanting to kill me, so I'll go down. I asked them what was the matter. They said, we can't get them out. They dive into the ground on us. And I should talk to them about it. I took them up. I went up. Single seat it was. And if you dived them, you couldn't pull them out. And they used to do their blocks. The only way I could pull them out was with the engine. See? I put her in a dive and she's falling out of the sky, and I just opened the engine straight up, and up she come. And they never had the sense to, when they start to dive on them, they lost complete control. They just fell out of the skies. And that was the finish of them. They finished up that, they mastered them then. A Graham White biplane for night flying we had. Graham Whites, they were one of the originals. And the cold one was the twin engine machine that I went over the lines, and you could have thrown an egg at it and hit it. And I flew a Blériot French machine. It was the first one that ever crossed the channel. But I didn't cross the channel, there was the water on it. But it was in Dover. How they got it there, I don't know. It was flown by the Frenchman, Blériot. And landed and left it, was put in the hangar at Dover, and I asked them could they start it up, and they said yes. Well, I said start it up and I'll take it up, and it flew all right too. It was before the war started, that one. That was the earliest machine that flew the channel, isn't that right?
Yes,
well, there, I don't know. I've had some funny experiences. I looked down at up at Redcar in the north of England. I saw an Australian soldier looking over the fence. And I went down, he was a sergeant. And I said, hello sergeant, what are you doing here? He said, I came up here to see if I could get a flight. I said, you've got no hope in the world of getting a flight. They said, what made you think you'd get a flight here? He said, they tell me there's an Australian here and he'd probably take me up. Well, it was a court-martial if you did it. Well, I said, you mean to tell me you came all the way for a flight? He said, yes. Well, I said, what, you on leave? He said, yes, I've got 14 days leave. And I said, where are you going? He said, I've got nowhere to go. Well, I said, come on and I'll put you in the petty officer's mess, which is the same rank as the soldiers. And you can stay here for your holidays. So the afternoon, I was walking around, and he was looking at the machines, and I said, you'd like to go up? He said, who would I? I said, come on, I'll take you up. He said, I might give you trouble. I took him up. He said, God's gospel. I looped the loop with him 13 times, just like that. Landed him. I reckon I'll make this bugger sick. And I said, what do you think of it? He said, lovely, take us up again. Anyhow, he put in the fortnight there. Well, 4 years after, when I came back to Australia, I was walking up, came from the railway, and I don't know how I got down that end of the railway inn. I think I'd been to the Hotel Sydney to book in. And I walked up Castle Ray Street. You know, there's a, some of you are sure to know it, there's a little block of land next door to Strange's. A fellow that they had a tire place opposite the fire brigade station. Do you know the spot? Well, there used to be a tire place there. And the fellow run over the road to me, he said, "Excuse me, you're Captain Cornfielder." I said, "How do you know me?" He said, "I want you to do something for me." I said, "Why, what can I do for you?" He said, "I want you to come over these bastards over here." He said, "You loop the loop with me 13 times and they won't believe me. Come over and tell them." No, you wouldn't believe that. That's true. That's true. I can never, I don't know that. Sorry I didn't know that fellow's name. But I, you know what a, those things have gone down like that. What do you call them? I just can't think of the name of them.
Parachute.
No, they come straight down.
Helicopter.
Helicopter. I can't spell. The thing is, I am prepared to say that I was the first pilot in the world to bring a machine down that way. No, sorry I didn't know this fellow's name, but I, you know what a, those things have gone down like that. What do you call them? I just can't think of the name of them.
Parachute.
What?
Parachute.
Who?
Parachute.
You know, they come straight down.
Helicopter.
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 I can't spell. The thing is, I am prepared to say that I was the first pilot in the world to bring a machine down that way. Now that's true. They were talking in the mess one day and they said, "Oh, no one could bring a machine down like that." I said, "Anyone game to come up with me?" And a young fellow from Casterton in Victoria, he was there, I can't think of his name, he's since died and I can't verify it. I took him up, all the aerodrome mob turned out in line. Mob was about 300 or 400 staff there. Take that as the middle of the aerodrome here. I went up to 2,000 feet, slightly over the centre, in an Avro, stood her up like that and I brought her down like that. And I was telling him as I was coming down, he was in the back seat and I was in the front seat, and I was telling him how many, so many feet we did in so much time. And I said, when we got down to about 60 or 70 feet, I said, "Now pull your knees up because we're going to crash." And she started to turn like that and landed on one wing, behind where I took off. And I guarantee you I was the first in the world that ever did it. And that's true. And I don't think there was anything in the world that I couldn't do in an aeroplane. I had one of my pupils coming in to land and I said to him, "For God's sake, you've gone mad. Let the controls go." We're going straight at the hangar and I swung it to the left and right like that and finished up in the hangar. That's true. Twisted around, broke nothing. If she'd have gone straight ahead, she'd have killed the CO. But he was in the side of the building. But I had a lot of funny experiences. I don't know There's one thing here I'd like you to read. Will you read it? They happen to be the ribbons I've got. Would you like to read that for me?
I'll do that for you.
Now this is the story of the death of Rich Stover. If you want to see me, there I am.
Who killed the Red Baron? I know, says the 81-year-old Sydney flying veteran. I have kept silent all these years because of the Australian claims. I did not want to hurt anyone's feelings. At 10:15 on the morning of Sunday, April the 21st, 1918, a legend fell out of the skies above the sleepy little town of Cerisy in northern France. The legend was Baron Manfred von Richthofen. At 25, he was the hero of every red-blooded man in the civilized world. Rich, talented, handsome beyond belief, he was idolized by millions of women. Fan letters and proposals of marriage reached him every day by the truckload. Richthofen, the Red Baron, the terror of the hour. For more than 50 years, tales of his dashing exploits, his valor, his incredible genius had been immortalized in song and story around the world. His death, shrouded in mystery and ringed by controversy for half a century, had been the subject of violent argument among the greatest historians of our time. Now, on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the Royal Air Force, whose ranks he thinned like scythe through a summer of wheat, comes a remarkable story from the Australian instructor of the man who shot him down. His name? Captain Austin Fritz Fraunfelder, one of the four Australian World War I pilots invited by the British Defence Ministry to a historic reunion of veterans of the original Royal Flying Corps to be held in London on June the 2nd. This is from the Daily Telegraph, 1972. Yesterday I spoke with Fritz about the trip. A spry, alert, young, 81-year-old who became one of the greatest racehorse owners and breeders in the land. He recalled the days of daring dogfights over the Somme, and he unlocked the secrets that he has kept bottled up since that misty morning when the Baron's brilliant scarlet Fokker triplane thudded into the earth on the outskirts of Cerisy. But first, to the events leading up to the death of Richthofen. Dubbed affectionately by the Kaiser, his ace of aces, the invincible Red Baron lorded the skies over the war-torn battlefields of France. 80 British planes fell victim to his deadly twin Spandau machine guns. He gathered around him the Red Circus, a squadron of 18 of the finest pilots in the Fatherland, and together they wreaked havoc on the French-based squadrons of the Royal Flying Corps. Baron received 26 decorations for valour and, it was said, could climb into his Red Fokker at St. Moritz in German-occupied France and trundle up into the clouds to shoot down a couple of Allied aircraft for the amusement of visiting generals. His popularity as a performer has probably never been equaled. He commanded the adulation of the Beatles, Elvis Presley, and Cassius Clay rolled into one, for the added spice that each time he went on to the show, he laid his life on the line. When he returned to Germany on leave, tens of thousands lined the streets to cheer him everywhere he went. But Manfred von Richthofen had one burning ambition, the Blue Max, highest award for bravery in the German war machine. Just after 9 o'clock in the morning on April the 21st, 1918, he set out to get it. Leading the Red Circus, he climbed to 12,000 feet and cruised above Bertin, where the Australian infantry were locked in battle with the Kaiser's troops. It looked like being a thin morning, when at 10:25 he spotted two RE-8 British reconnaissance planes about 2,000 feet below. Baron disdained to attack himself, but he sent his squadron zooming down to blast the lumbering giants out of the sky. An hour earlier, Captain Roy Brown, a Canadian RAF officer, swung into the air at the head of a flight of Sopwith Camels from the Allied airfield of Bertang, and he too was scanning the skies for prey. He spotted the Huns falling on the Hapdis R-8s and dispatched 5 fighters to the rescue. From 15,000 feet, he circled below a bank of cloud, watching the dogfight. Suddenly, a Sopwith piloted by Flight Lieutenant Wap May broke off in a steep downward bank, and in an instant, the Red Baron was hurtling on his tail. May plunged and weaved, throwing his kite around the sky in a desperate bid to escape the most deadly guns in the air. Seeing May caught in the claws of the eagle, Brown pushed the blood-red nose of his Sopwith downwards and fell on the Baron. His thumbs jarred down on the trigger buttons, and a stream of lead ripped into the Fokker. Pictofen, completely taken by surprise, turned in his cockpit, and for a moment Brown saw his eyes through flying goggles. They were wide in disbelief. Then the Baron slumped forward. The famous red tripe lurched, banked steeply to the right, and fell like a stone to the battlefield below. Baron died with a bullet clean through the heart. Same time as Roy Brown fired on the Fokker, an Australian gun crew below poured a fuselage of bullets towards her. In the subsequent inquiry, there were claims and counterclaims as to who had administered the coup de grace. The Australians claimed Richtofen as a kill. Roy Brown was officially credited with shooting him down. A gunner in one of the British RE-8s piped up and said that he had fired the fatal shot. There was even a suggestion that the Baron was alive when the plane struck the rutted earth of Sedisi. He was shot in cold blood by Australian infantry. Fritz Flornfelder, an Australian to his bootstraps, has no reservations. As he told me, I have kept silent all these years because of the Australian claims. I would not want to hurt anyone's feelings. But now most of the people concerned are dead. Now I want to speak out. Roy Brown shot down the Baron. There is no question of that. After active air combat in France until 1916, I was a senior pilot training officer in England. I trained and coached Roy Brown and scores of other RAF pilots. Roy had been on active service for many months. He was approaching a breakdown. He was sent to me for rehabilitation, and together we flew many practice missions to build up his confidence. As a pilot instructor, I had studied the tactics of all the leading fighter pilots of the day, and particularly Richtofen. Over a beer in the mess, I said to Roy, "You want to get the Baron? Right, I'll tell you how. There are 18 planes in each squadron, but the circus has 19. 18 of them fly at 12,000 feet, and the Baron lurks 2,000 feet above them. When they attack, he waits until the British plane breaks away, and then he falls on it from above and behind. You want to get him, climb 2,000 feet above, and when he falls, you follow him down. You'll be so engrossed in his kill that you'll have him cold." And that's exactly what he did. He played the Baron at his own game, and he won.
That's a true story.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's no doubt about it. We've had a great pleasure in listening to Captain Throwenfelder tonight. Not only in giving us such a wide field of experience in World War I flying, but he spiced it with the human touch, the humorous touch, and I'm quite certain we've all enjoyed it immensely. I'm now going to call upon Mr. Sid Hertz, who I know has been a student of the Royal Naval Air Service for many years, to move a vote of thanks on your behalf.
Sir, thanks very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on your behalf, it gives me great pleasure, Captain, to move this vote of thanks to you. Tonight I have here my good friend Ron Cooper from the Australian Society of World War I Aero Historians, and naturally he'd come along to hear this. What you didn't tell the Society, Captain, was that your pilot's licence number was 1,309, ladies and gentlemen, which is a very, very low number. You see, in those days, even though you were a military pilot or a Royal Naval Air Service pilot, you still had to have a military, you still had to have an aviation certificate issued by the Royal Aeronautical Society, and the captain's number was 1,309, which is a very, very low number, so that'll give you some idea of how early in the piece that he was flying. And of course you didn't tell us about the raw courage that was required to fly all those machines that you flew, such as never wearing a parachute, and if it became a flamer, which every pilot, as you well know, dreaded, it was good night, because there was no way whatsoever to put the flames out, and the raw courage required to do what you did with the night flying, when there was no navigational aids at all, and the only way you could find your way back to your aerodrome was by, as you stated, following the railway lines, and when the ground crew heard a plane coming, they'd run out like mad and start lighting up kerosene flares to get you down, and if you were lucky and didn't land in some town, mistake the lights of some town for an aerodrome and go down. And I've got to say this, that in those days it was certainly raw courage that you men had to do what you did, because there's no doubt about it, there was no way whatsoever that you could save yourself if anything went wrong. And I was very interested to hear that you had flown all those planes. One little thing which I think, when you spoke about the camel being the best fighter in the world, you were correct in that, but one thing you didn't say was that the camel, even though it was the best fighter in the world, was also the hardest plane in the world to fly, because the pilot could not get used to the radial engine turning. You see, the engine turned on these, and the pots turned, and many a pilot was in before he knew where he went. And as the captain said, it was the most famous fighter, the Suffolk Camel, in the world. And then he spoke about the Bristol. Of course, the Bristol, what he said about the Bristol was correct. I mean, the Bristol had a name. It was called the Brisbit. Remember that? The Brisbit, it was called. And he spoke about the Avro, and of course the Avro, there was no doubt about the Avro. The Avro, without a doubt, was one of the finest planes that was ever turned out. And right through to 1918 and beyond 1918, ladies and gentlemen, the Avro was in use. Am I correct in that?
You bet.
Yes, the Royal Air Force was flying the Avro up to about 1921 and 1922 in Egypt and through there. Anyhow, I'm not here to give another lecture on history of the flying corps, but you've certainly kept us entertained, and you've proved one point here tonight. Last month we had an 88-year-old gentleman who kept us entertained. Tonight we've got a gentleman of over 80. You've proved one point, that you can hold your own with any youth. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.